we felt as we started covering politics initially based in Brussels, the ambition was always to do something pan-European, so not just to cover Brussels. But then with the Brexit referendum and with the result, of course, we saw traffic and interest in the UK explode, and suddenly it felt as though what we were covering in Brussels was central to people's lives in the UK in a way that it really hadn't felt before.
And that quote you just heard is from Kate Day, who is the UK editor for Politico Europe. We spoke about its expansion into and growth in the UK market and discussed everything from the advantages of being a startup publisher in a world of legacy giants, how they choose what goes behind the paywall, and what sets UK politics coverage apart from the rest of Europe. Welcome to Media Voices. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
There is, what would you say, a theme to this week's news roundup?
Is there any other news?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, the first thing to say is that we hope the listeners are all safe and keeping well.
And staying inside your homes, please.
Yeah, stay home, guys.
Yeah, but this has been so disruptive, and it's been so disruptive to so many industries. And as you're going to see from this news roundup, it feels like the news industry particularly is going to be hit by this quite hard.
Okay, so, you need to read out my title for this, though. I've highlighted
okay.
it.
All right. So Esther has written Print in a Pandemic.
Yay!
And the first item on our news roundup is that Playboy has announced that it's closing down its flagship print magazine for the rest of the year. Am I right in thinking that it also closed print previously?
Well, it didn't close, but it stopped.
It went quarterly, didn't it?
Yeah, it stopped doing what it had been doing. It stopped Nudes and they went quarterly.
Yeah.
No, Nudes are back, because when they stopped Nudes, the circulation plummeted. So yeah,
Nudes are back in a big way.
Who knew?
But in like the 4 years that we've been doing this podcast, I feel like Playboy has tried to reinvent itself about, I don't know, two or three times now.
Well, it's just been a kind of ongoing process, hasn't it?
Well, the CEO, Ben Cohn, said that we were forced to accelerate a conversation we've been having internally, the question of how to transform our US print product to better suit what consumers want today.
In other words, coronavirus is a convenient excuse.
Or rather, it's like it was the straw that broke the camel's back if it wasn't a convenient excuse.
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't said they're closing it though, have they?
Nope.
They've said that they're closing it for the duration.
Well, they have sort of said a little bit about what they're planning for next year. They've said that they're looking to bring back fresh and innovative print offerings. So not the regular magazine anymore. They've kind of hinted at, you know, special editions, partnerships.
They'll go magazine.
Yeah, the coffee table Playboy.
Well, you say that, but I know a couple
bedside
people...
table
in the Me Too era. They've
got, yeah,
they've got naked lady pictures on their coffee table.
Yeah, absolutely.
Better the coffee table than on the toilet seat.
Jesus, irony. The irony.
I mean, yeah, it sounds like the Playboy have been moving towards this bookazine, you know, premium limited run model for quite some time, and this is
they haven't really ever managed to get themselves to that luxury stage, though, have they? They've kind of always meandered around the middle.
Which is odd, because Playboy as a brand is so centred around this idea of the luxury lifestyle.
Yeah. And it's all, and the production values have always been, you know, top notch in terms of print.
Are we just too woke now?
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, it's not, well, it's not just that. If your proclivity is for naked flesh, then you don't need to be dropping a fiver or £8 or whatever it costs for Playboy anymore. You can get it any way you want.
So my theory here is that actually now is the best time to keep producing Playboy, because as people are at home and their bandwidth is throttled because everybody else is at home, you can get it in print instead.
God.
Could we choose our language a little bit more carefully here?
I think the two of you have been extremely cynical. There was more to Playboy than just
the interviews.
The pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah,
people
and the
only
fiction
ever
and
read
the
it for the interviews.
Oh, come on, the high-caliber journalism.
I mean, they published stuff by like Roald Dahl and Harlan Ellison, all those kind of people.
Amazing writers.
But like, you're right, they're right at the center of that Venn diagram of titillations found online for free and the idea that celebrity news and interviews can be found online anyway.
Yep. And also, you know, there's a bigger thing, I think. Playboy brand got absolutely trashed.
Yeah.
It went out, you know, school kids had it on their pencil cases and on their shoes and on their hats. You could buy all sorts of crap with that Playboy logo on it. And I think that brand got absolutely trashed.
It's cheapened it.
Yeah, definitely. And they, you know, they'll still make a fortune off of that brand licensing.
Oh yeah, so if you read the announcement they put out about this, half of it is basically completely bigging up the commercial side of what they've made. Yeah. Like, you know, 97% of people recognise what the tuxedoed bunny is. It's like, well, jolly good.
So, Peter, why don't you take us through this next news item?
Well, this is a more serious story, I think, more important
than Playboy.
The big issue. So obviously the big issue is a magazine, a hand up, not a hand out. People sell it. They keep half the money that they make from selling the magazine for themselves. It's, you know, been going for 25 years plus to help homeless people. And it gets people back into work. And the model doesn't work right now because we can't be out in the streets, or we're not out in the streets buying the paper, buying the magazine. So they're having some real issues in terms of how are they going to keep getting money to the vendors, how are they going to keep going, I guess, from an operational point of view. If they're, because it's not just the vendors that aren't making any money, it's also the big issue as an operation, as a publication. So they're pushing hard for people to take a digital subscription, which I did just last week. $32.50 gets you 13 issues delivered to your door. Everyone should do it because, apart from anything else, The Big is just a really good magazine. There's good writing in it.
But there's a really interesting problem here, isn't there? Because individual sellers will use selling the magazine as a way to earn their own income.
Yeah.
And how much you earn, like, obviously depends on where you are, how good you are at selling it. But if you buy it online, you're not buying it from the seller.
Absolutely.
And so there's this huge issue about how... I know the UK editor Paul McNamee has said that all these online sales will go to central pot, but even he said that they're still figuring out how to get it to the vendors when they need it, because that's a huge issue. You know, you can't really split it equally, but at the same time...
Well, I guess maybe what they look at is people's historic sales and base it, the percentage of the monies that they get will be based on that. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that regardless, it's worth applauding them for the speed with which they have
they've
done
been
this.
All over this.
Yeah,
and I saw John Budd was tweeting about it. I think they put out a statement just last week, and they've really been pushing the digital.
Exactly. And, you know, even if they haven't worked out quite how that, you know, recompense is going to happen, they are, the structure now is in place where they can start building that pot to then be distributed down the line. I think it's really good of Paul McNamee to have said, you know, we haven't figured this out yet, but we are
working
on it.
Yeah, it's very honest.
They've put the magazine up. So I think it was £2.50 before, which was split 50-50 between the vendor and the magazine. Yeah. But they're putting it up to £3, and they're saying that extra 50p is just going straight to the vendor because of what's going on.
I mean, it's a great operation. I mean, you know, it's not perfect, but they make a real effort to help these guys out and do a good magazine. And that to me, that's the point. If it was just like, we'll give these guys this crappy magazine and they can sell it and it's a charity thing and everyone, you know, will just chip in, well, that's one thing. But they're actually producing a really good magazine. And it would be a real shame if they took a hit because they can't sell it that way. I think the other thing is, what Esther's saying is right on a different level as well, that idea that people buy the magazine because of who's selling it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, there's a guy, remember when we worked in Pimlico, there was a guy that sold it outside Pimlico Tube Station, and he was brilliant. You know, he would actually tell you what was in the issue, and he'd be like, oh, this is really good. I remember he showed me that, he says, oh, you got to see this. And it was a Trump melted face picture or whatever. And he says, you got to see this, is really funny. And you had that kind of relationship with the vendor that, I think the problem with digital subscriptions is you just don't get that.
I suppose the thing here, though, is that when and if we ever go back to normal life, is this going to now be an opportunity for the big issue that, you know, if you are working from home or you don't come across sellers, in your day-to-day life, that you can buy digital subscription to support them, and then the normal distribution will kind of pick up again.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's expanding what they do. Like, it's almost forced them to expand what they do.
Well, they always had that digital subscription. They just didn't push it. I did a thing with these guys with a big issue, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where we tried to figure out, it was like a workshop for the INSP, and we tried to figure out how street papers could go digital, and it's really hard, because the big thing is that it's not just about making money, it's about giving homeless people something to do, it's about giving homeless people a purpose, it's about making people on the streets understand, it's about making people that are just walking by understand that homeless people are real people, and too, there's all sorts going on there.
Yeah.
That it's not just a transaction. So yeah, maybe they can expand the digital subscription side of things, but I just hope that the physical side of it goes back to where it was.
On that note about distribution, though, City AM has stopped distributing its papers this week.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly, there's actually nobody in London. But they've put a huge number of their staff on ice as well. It's 50% pay cuts there.
Yeah, it's all over the place. Even in Standard, it's the same. It's cut its circulation to 500,000 because, there is effectively no footfall in the capital, and they rely on that. And, advertising spend has fallen as well. Well, Mike Souter said, in the context of currently lower advertising volumes, it makes good economic sense too. So there is partly that kind of consideration that needs to go into anything that's got free distribution.
Yep.
I want that stylist app ASAP.
And in fact, Esther, why don't you take us through what's happening with the regional papers as well? Because there's a kind of similar thing going on there.
Yeah, I think this is another kind of sort of good news story. I mean, as good as you can get at the moment with regional publishers. So there's a group of kind of local publishers, Archant, Reach, JPI Media, NewsQuest and iLife, that have joined forces this week to launch a hashtag There With You campaign. And they've basically just run, like 80 of these papers have run the same front page, just saying, when you're on your own, we're there with you. And it's kind of this kind of idea that, you're keeping the community together, you're involving elderly and vulnerable people, and you're kind of reaching people in their homes. And I think it's one of those cases that certainly in the UK, this could actually be one of those moments where regional publishers can really shine.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah. I mean, so I like the message. I like the idea. I don't know what it signifies long term, other than them basically setting out their stall and saying, hey, here's what we have been doing for some time. Is this going to change anybody's mind about picking up a local news subscription? I don't see that it will.
I think they've got to follow up with actual local news and helping people out. Here's something that's going on locally, here's a helpline, here's whatever. The National did a thing where they put a helpline number on the front page.
All right, can I read you to a little paragraph from Jane Martinson's article on this topic in The Guardian?
You can.
So she said, she's talking about exactly what provision local news has and sort of what resources it has to help its communities during this crisis. And she said, the BBC offered measures to help social cohesion in the crisis last week, in doing so appearing like the adult in the room while the government still seemed like a teenager. But it could still do more to help local news providers, maybe helping to drive traffic to local news sites. All well and good so far. Then, she says, there should be a way of making this support for local communities rather than greedy owners which have bled their local newspapers dry and are only now squealing, which is, I know, amazing language and exactly right. This is exactly what we've been talking about when you talk about taking the costs out and making it impossible for local news to provide this service when it really matters.
Yeah.
But I think it's not all good. I think in the US it's a bit of a different situation because for the US weeklies, at least, social distancing has meant that they've essentially lost a lot of their advertising revenue because it's all around events and, what's going on locally. So, there are loads of US local titles that are basically like asking for donations or laying off staff or, like, abandoning print entirely, which is not great. So there's a lot of people saying, I think Nieman Lab described it as total annihilation.
Well, Time Out had that masthead changed, didn't it? Time In.
Yeah, that's a really good idea.
That was brilliant.
And you know what? Talking about that, necessity being the mother of invention and stuff, even places like Tortoise, their thinkings...
Tortoise.
Tortoise. Their thinkings are digital now. They're working out how they can do that in a sort of purely digital capacity.
No, I'm really looking forward to the history book that actually details all this in about 10 years' time once we're all, if we're all survived.
We should
that.
Pitch it.
I think it'll be a great history book.
We should pitch that now.
Or at the very least, the coronavirus issue of delayed gratification.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, they'll
that's
be on.
Going to be a cracker.
I'm waiting for Pandemic the Musical.
Oh, you want to see something? Go on YouTube Movies and look at the bestsellers at the moment. Pandemic, Contagion, World War Z.
Perfect.
It's just this fucking catalogue of disaster pandemic
well,
movies.
I've already
it,
seen it on Netflix.
While we're on it, I've got a Spotify playlist called The End Time Boogie. 50 songs for the end of the world.
Oh.
So good.
This week I spoke with Kate Day, who is the UK's editor for Politico Europe, about its expansion into and growth in the UK market. We started by going over exactly what the UK expansion will look like and the reasons behind choosing the UK as a staging ground.
I'm Kate Day. I'm Politico's executive editor in the UK. And I've been at Politico since 2015, when Politico teamed up with Axel Springer to launch a version of Politico in Europe. Initially, I spent a lot of time travelling between London and Brussels on the Eurostar, and then gradually we've launched Politico in the UK back in 2017 with London Playbook and with a Brexit subscription product, which I run both of those. And now we're on the point of expanding into the UK, so I'm spending less time on the Eurostar and more time in London.
And how are you finding that? Less time looking out at the nice scenery, I suppose, but actually more time to get work done.
Yeah, I mean, the travel has its own challenges. It's actually been a fantastically interesting period to be travelling because of Brexit. So I was seeing the negotiations at both ends of the Eurostar regularly, which I think has been very helpful and very interesting. But of course, it's nice to spend more time at home as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned that in terms of the travel as well, but just in terms of when you joined and everything that's happened since then, it must have been, you know, boom time for Politico, just in terms of everything they were covering and what they could launch.
It was. Well, interestingly, when I first decided to join, I remember telling a few colleagues and friends in the media that I was interested in this startup that was going to cover European politics. And a few people sort of raised half an eyebrow and said, really, is that what you want to spend your time doing? Is European politics that interesting? And I said, I think it might be about to get really interesting. And I had no idea just how true that was going to prove to be. But yeah, the week I landed in Brussels, two things happened. One, David Cameron came across to kick off his renegotiation with Donald Tusk on Britain's relationship with Europe. So that was the very same week I joined the company. And then the second thing was the Paris attacks with the end of that week. So I came back after my first week in Brussels, came back to London for the weekend, and the Paris attacks struck. So yeah, news got incredibly busy, and covering European politics and policy has been fascinating. So
I mean, 0-60 in terms of, you know, how people must think about what you cover, because as you mentioned, kind of from something that people thought might not be a particularly not particularly active beat, to suddenly it's at the centre of everything that's happening politically in the UK.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been one of the key advantages, I think, for Politico. We felt, as we started covering politics initially based in Brussels, the ambition was always to do something pan-European, so not just to cover Brussels. But then with the Brexit referendum and with the result, of course, we saw traffic and interest in the UK explode, and suddenly it felt as though what we were covering in Brussels was central to people's lives in the UK in a way that it really hadn't felt before.
Yeah, absolutely. And so was that really the main cause behind sort of turning your eyes to a sort of more UK-centric expansion? Or was that sort of something that had always been on the cards?
I think it had always been on the cards in some way, though when I joined, there wasn't a very clear vision as to how that would pan out. But then the Brexit referendum and that process and campaign, and obviously the result itself, accelerated our thinking. Suddenly we had an audience, and a huge audience, that was really interested. We felt as though by being a non-partisan news provider with a huge amount of policy expertise in Brussels particularly, we were offering something very distinct compared to the UK national media market. And it felt like we would be silly not to use that advantage in order to accelerate our growth plans. So yeah, it definitely sped things up, I would say.
Yeah, certainly. And actually, just before we get into, because you said some things there that I really want to touch on, but you know, would you say then that, in fact, what form is the expansion taking? What's this new team in London going to look like? Or rather, what's the new publishing strategy going to look like?
So really, the plan is to build on our strengths. We've had two key products that have led a lot of the coverage in the UK so far. One is our Brexit coverage. So our Westminster coverage is really focused around Brexit. And of course, that pairs up very closely with reporters in Brussels and indeed in other national capitals, Berlin and Paris and so on. So our Brexit coverage has been very strong. And our other key strength in the UK is London Playbook, our morning newsletter. So building on those two components of what we do, we want to both expand the policy coverage, some of which is behind a paywall, and also build out our free coverage of Westminster. So we'll be looking at new policy areas to complement what we already cover with Brexit, and then also look to launch some new free products which cover Westminster more broadly, but from a national point of view, if you like. So digging very much into Westminster coverage for an audience in Westminster, as opposed to covering UK politics for a global audience.
I see. I mean, it sounds like a tremendous amount of work, but at the same time, launching new products like that is always, we find, one of the most fun parts of doing anything like this, particularly when it is around a topic that's so vital to people's lives.
It's great fun. I'm not going to lie, that pleasure of coming up with ideas and really relatively quickly. It's one of the joys of being at a startup, relatively quickly, something you sketch out on the back of an envelope, often quite literally with a few other very smart people, turns into a real product fast. And that's very exciting. It can also be terrifying. I remember launching London Playbook was very exciting until about 6 weeks before we went live.
It suddenly looks concrete.
And suddenly it's concrete, and all sorts of people were telling me there were too many newsletters in British politics. It was never going to work. I was, embarking on something crazy, and I had just hired Jack Blanchard from The Mirror, tempted him away from a very good job, and I thought, my goodness, what have I done? This could go very, very wrong very quickly, and thankfully it didn't at all. But yeah, it has its moments of being terrifying, but it's also hugely exhilarating.
Well, in fact, you've touched upon the next question I'm going to ask a couple of times so far in your answers. Trust in news outlets at the moment does seem to be at a premium. You know, I spoke to Newsworks and then Nick Newman from the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism the other day, and they had a little bit of contrasting opinions on what trust in the media actually looks like now. But how is Politico then rising above that noise? How is it rising above that partisanship and convincing audiences to really trust its editorial?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and it's something we spend a lot of time thinking about, because particularly, well, for all our media, and when you're coming in as a startup, this feels particularly key. And if you're not trusted, then you haven't got anything, right? And we're coming in with no reputation. Initially, I was ringing people up and explaining every time I made a phone call what Politico was, what we covered, what we were interested in, that I was a journalist. You know, there's an awful lot of kind of basic understanding of a news brand that if you're starting without it, you have to work from the bottom up and really build that trust. So we spend a lot of time thinking about it. I think one of the keys from my point of view, and particularly leading Politico in the UK, is that we're non-partisan. So unlike so much of the media here, we sit squarely in the middle. And actually, again, the policy coverage means that's vital for us, because most of our subscribers are using our journalism to make decisions about their job. And therefore, if there was any suggestion that we had a bias or a worldview that somehow influenced the coverage, it would immediately be less valuable to them, and therefore our model wouldn't work. So it's absolutely key that we give every side a fair hearing, raise difficult and sceptical questions of everyone, but treat everyone fairly and really hit stories straight as opposed to coming in with an agenda. And that is something we've worked very, very hard to establish. It goes all the way down to things like how you describe your sources for a story. Mm. We try as much as possible to give readers as much detail as we can. We do, of course, speak to some people who would prefer not to be identified, and they often have very valuable information that we think it is worth reporting and worth sharing with readers, but we try and describe who those people are in as much detail as possible so that readers can make an assessment about how to treat that information. So right down to individual descriptions of sources, it's something we spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about and working on as we're producing stories and editing.
So it's really at the heart of the editorial process is making sure that you're as transparent as possible and that people can, you're providing the audience with enough information to make up their own minds. You're not necessarily even trying to put across a particular point of view.
Absolutely. And because we know we have very smart professional readers, we expect them to know probably more than we do, certainly as much as we do, and about their specialist areas, they'll know more than we do. So we very much treat them straight and explain to them, you know, this is something we know for sure, this is something maybe we don't know, and we try and be very clear about that in our reporting. Also down to, for example, providing original documents. So a lot of our subscription service, one of the most valuable things we hear from readers a lot is they love getting original source material. So sometimes we will write about a new policy by, you know, explaining what we think the policy means and talking to people about what it means. But sometimes we will just provide our readers with that source material directly themselves, and they find that very valuable. I think that also helps build trust.
Yeah, certainly. And who is it then that you see as being your target audience? You mentioned kind of it's the fact that they're decision makers, but who then are you sort of speaking to on a daily basis?
So our target readers, I guess we think about as a sort of community, and they're mostly people who work in politics, have some kind of professional stake in politics. That might be because they work in government, they're civil servants or political advisors. It might be that they work for businesses, but are usually advising on politics and policy in some capacity. That's our core audience. We, of course, attract a wider readership, particularly for London Playbook, for example, the morning newsletter. There are certainly readers of London Playbook who are well-educated, intelligent people who are interested in politics and love to get a more insidery view of Westminster, who don't necessarily work in Westminster. Yeah. But they're very much the outer ring, I guess, of our audience. Our core audience, who we are most focused on, are people who work in politics in some capacity.
Politico does seem to exist at this kind of sweet spot of both expertise and accessibility in terms of its coverage. So is that tone and is that publishing strategy something that you think about just as much as you think about who your audience is, making sure that everything's readily accessible to anyone who might stumble across the page for the first time?
Yes, absolutely. And it goes right back to the heart of the idea for Politico, right back in its inception in the US in 2007. One of our founding editors, John Harris, likes to tell a story that when he was an editor for the Washington Post, he got increasingly frustrated because he always felt that having a drink with his reporters was much more interesting than reading their copy. There was something in the way that they talked about politics, the way they talked about the human beings who were making decisions, that was so much more compelling. And they sort of stripped that out when they wrote it up for the Washington Post because they felt there was a certain style that was acceptable, and a lot of the more human interest drivers that were actually shaping the way politics was playing or the way policy decisions were being made, that all got stripped out somehow in the traditional editorial process. And he wanted to inject that back in. And he felt if you focused on the people and if you told stories in a way that was very accessible and fun and lively, you could do a much better job, or certainly a much more compelling, addictive style of journalism. And that really goes to the heart of how we still think about Politico stories.
Yeah, certainly. And there's so much to unpack there. I mean, talk about things being lively, though. The news around, say, Brexit, and obviously if we're looking at the current crisis, the news around it moves so quickly. How do you maintain, you know, kind of that authenticity and that expertise when things are changing on a daily basis?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, it's challenging. There's an awful lot going on and there's an awful lot to unpack. I think the key for us is taking time to really allow journalists to develop expertise in policy areas. So we have this huge resource in our policy teams, most of whom are based in Brussels, and now we're starting to expand some of those policy teams more substantially in the UK. They really know a subject area. So if, for example, with our health team, they've been covering the way drugs and vaccines come onto the market, they're covering that all the time. When you then have a story like the corona crisis, suddenly you have a pool of expertise to really draw on. If you can find a way of making that policy knowledge accessible and digestible and compelling and interesting for a more general interest reader, then I think you're onto something very special.
In terms of the UK audience then, are there any considerations that are unique to the UK, either in terms of how the audiences think about content, whether that's on sort of more cynically, or in terms of how you go about reaching them? You know, are there any UK specific considerations for this new launch?
There are plenty that inform our thinking. I would say one key one that we've drawn on for London Playbook, and I think will carry on driving some of the thinking here, and it's a sort of point that feels quite obvious in the UK, but when you think about it, it's actually very different to other countries in the world. And that's the pace of the news cycle here and the way that it plays out. So we still have a news cycle that is driven not exclusively, but in large part by print media and by drops of news very late at night.
Okay.
And so because of that cycle, that really shapes a day, and that shapes the points in the day when your competitors are going to be launching news, when other people in your audience, particularly in a specialist audience, are engaging with the news. And that cycle looks quite different in America, where, for example, news really is breaking on a rolling basis. So much of it is driven by breaking news on TV, and that happens 24 hours a day, you know, round the clock. The pace of that news cycle is a bit different. Or somewhere at the other end of the spectrum, like Brussels, where there isn't a sort of national media landscape with competing daily papers. There are mostly correspondents working for their home country and based in Brussels, covering their home country as a foreign correspondent. So the pace of the news cycle is different in these different places, and I think that has shaped the products we already have, and that will carry on shaping products we have in future.
Yeah, and you mentioned before kind of the split between the new paid-for products that you're thinking about, your existing paid-for product, and some of the free-to-access ones. How then are you deciding what's valuable enough, or rather what's attractive enough to sit behind a paywall or sort of another payment method to convince people, you know, to go down that funnel?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and again, one we think about a lot. And to start with, we have certain components of the subscription service that are there regardless. So we're not making a decision day by day. They have their own components, such as morning newsletters for the policy areas, and some access to data and to tools that is exclusive for subscribers. So there are some components that are there all the time, and they then get breaking news alerts, which are short bursts of any breaking news through the day or night that we think they subscribers need to know, that get sent to them directly, and then also longer features and interviews and sort of more substantial stories.
Yeah.
On the free site, we do a little bit less of the granular policy coverage. We mostly save that for our paying subscribers, and we have slightly broader, more political stories, I guess. So there is a rhythm to the way the subscription products work, and we obviously have to ensure that we're really giving our readers good value and they are benefiting from the expertise of our policy teams. But as I was mentioning with Corona, sometimes we also pull across some of the policy expertise and include it in the free coverage, and it very much enriches the free coverage. So it's an ongoing debate, but we have certain mechanisms to ensure that there's always value for subscribers in the products.
Nice. And are you looking to any other publications for sort of a model that way? Do you think anybody's doing that kind of funnel particularly well, you know, even around politics?
It's an interesting question. I feel like our competition overlaps mostly in certain corners of what we're doing. So we've got lots of competitors on all sides, as it were, and no one doing exactly the Politico model. So for example, you get trade publications who focus very much on policy for different sectors, but they generally don't cover the politics. And you obviously get the national newspapers here that are full of political stories and covering politics all the time. And we definitely see as competition when we're going after scoops and trying to chase down stories. But they typically have less of the policy expertise. So where we really see our sweet spot is that mix of the two. And I don't see other people doing exactly that. So competition on all sides, but not really anyone quite in the space that we're in the way that we're in it.
That's really interesting. And do you think it would have been that case if you hadn't sort of come into it with that startup mentality? Because it seems like so many other places that cover politics so regularly are doing it from this kind of legacy standpoint where they have their ways of doing things. But it seems like you've got the freedom to experiment with that kind of stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think you're hugely liberated when you come from a startup. I was at The Telegraph for 9 years before I joined Politico. And from a national newspaper's perspective, there are certain things your readers expect you to do, right? So one of the things a newspaper has to do is narrate what happened yesterday broadly, give their readers a package of stories that tell them in general terms, designed for a very general audience, what matters in the world on any given morning. Politico and other startups are liberated from doing that. We can link to other people. We, as we regularly do in London Playbook, we will take you through the whole breadth of the news media coverage in the morning and tell you what we think matters and why, and offer insight and analysis and our own reporting in order to help you navigate that. But we don't have to give you the comprehensive picture of everything that's happened in the world since yesterday.
Yeah.
And so it means we can focus our journalism in other places and focus on delivering different things that national media don't do. If we were to come in and try and compete with national media, we wouldn't really have a business.
Yeah.
Because why would you come to a new startup if it's not really coming up with something that you can't get elsewhere? So
yes.
Yeah, it definitely forces you to think very hard about where's your added value, what are you doing that's different. If we were to just mimic other people or, you know, put out products that were too similar to what else was out there, I don't think we'd be successful.
And then as a final question that we ask all our guests, what would be one piece of media you've watched, read, listened to over the last couple of months that you'd really like to recommend, something that's made you, you know, that's engendered an emotional response in you?
That's such a good question. In these corona times, I feel like I'm very much in need of something that isn't about viruses and isn't about politics. I actually have been thinking a lot about Daniel Kitson.
Oh, yeah.
The comedian and storyteller. I don't know if this quite counts as media, but you can get some of his performances on YouTube, I think. It's definitely worth looking up. It's very heartening, and he does a wonderful job of illuminating the ordinary and the everyday in a way that is just wonderful and delightful. So I think people should all go and look up wonderful and delightful things through this crisis.
So if you're working from home all day, and if you're not working from home, what the f*** are you doing? What? You're going into the office?
Unless you're a key worker.
If you're working from home all day and you want to pretend you've got some really funny, hyper cool, nice company, Stu's laughing. We've got a growing archive of episodes to listen to featuring us three cool dudes.
It says mugs
in the notes, but I think it's cool dudes. And some brilliant guests, more importantly, some brilliant guests. Go to the voices.
Go to the voices.
Go to voices.media/discover to search by topic or find us wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We also have a newsletter which you can sign up to at voices.media. So while you're there browsing our archives, please do sign up. It goes out every Wednesday and contains a link to the latest episode, some links to what we've been reading around the web, and occasionally the odd link to what we've been writing as well.
And if you want to keep up with all the latest media news, we tweet every day at Media Voices Pod. We're trying to find non-coronavirus media-related stories, but it's kind of challenging.
Oh, send us your good news coronavirus stories.
Yeah, good news and good news coronavirus and dog pictures. So this week, please do stay safe, tell a friend about the Media Voices podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Stay inside.
Ta-ta.